All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio241. It's April 26th, right after spring break. You probably don't have any questions at all because you studied really hard over spring break. But in case you do have a question, I'll just ask for any questions right now. No questions? That's great. All right, the schedule calls for a test next time on the 28th. That's going to be exam 4. It's going to cover muscle physiology, then blood, heart, and circulation. Uh-oh, what happened? Sounded like my voice just went away. No? Okay. So let's carry on. So whether or not we finish this chapter today, you're going to have a test on it. So we can't waste too much time. We're talking about a Wiggers diagram. And whenever you look at a graph, the keys to understanding a graph is understand the axes of how the information is displayed, right? So that's the first thing you should always look for. So what we don't see on this plot right here is a time axis along the bottom on the horizontal scale, and then the vertical scale has a number of different axes because we're comparing a number of different properties of the heart. So for instance, this axis right here should be sound level. So we're measuring sound or listening to events within the heart versus time, right? And then this right here is the ECG. This is measuring electrical activity on the surface of your body that's being generated by all the millions of cells that make up your heart, and that corresponds to or that will translate to electrical currents on the surface of your body. And then we have a couple of other curves. We have a volume curve, volume versus time. And the volume that we're looking at, what volume are we looking at here? Okay. Did anybody tell me? Maybe I didn't quite hear what you said.
Chamber volume.
Chamber volume, and what particular chamber? The ventricle. So probably the left ventricle would be a good guess. And then here is pressure versus time. And we have pressures from different places within the heart. We have an atrial pressure. We have a ventricular pressure, and again, you could probably say the left ventricle, and then we have pressure in the aorta, and you see the pressures are all different. Now, why are we interested in pressure? Because that's going to determine blood flow, right? So blood is going to flow from where to where in terms of pressure. It's always going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. That's the driving force. So you could even think of that as being like diffusion, where molecules move from high concentration to low concentration. So that's the driving force. So that's why we have these different pressures plotted out. For instance, this probably dark blue line right here and kind of a like a red line right here. Is that pretty close? No, not even close. Wait, I got to get this cursor working. Pointer options, arrow options. Let's make it visible. Okay, so this blue line is really what color? It's blue. Okay. And what's this one right here?
Black.
Okay. So blue and black. So the reason why we have these plotted together, because it will tell us which way blood will be flowing between these two different compartments. So we have the aorta in black, and we have the ventricle in blue. And for instance, if the pressure is higher in the aorta than the ventricle, then blood will want to flow from the aorta into the ventricle. And is that allowed? Should that ever happen? And what prevents that from happening? A valve, right? So there's going to be a valve at the root of the aorta, namely the aortic semilunar valve, that prevents that from happening. But as soon as the pressure in the ventricle is greater than the pressure in the aorta, that valve opens up, and what happens? Blood is going to flow from the ventricle into the aorta, and that's what we can now monitor on this volume curve. So here we have a volume of the ventricle, and when blood starts to flow from the ventricle into the aorta, the volume of the ventricle does what? It decreases, right? So that's how you would analyze this curve. That's why we have these different pressure curves right here. All right, so how many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Okay, so we're not so concerned with all the different chambers of the heart, but we do have all four valves on this particular diagram. All right, so let's look at the pressures in the atria, right? So let's say left atrium, and we see that it's higher in the atrium than the ventricle, so which way is blood going to flow? If it's higher in the atria than the ventricle, which way will blood flow? It always goes from high to low, so it'll go from an atrium into a ventricle, and that's a proper flow. There shouldn't be a valve that's going to stop that process, right? That's still a nice anterograde flow of blood. So blood is going to flow from the atria into the ventricles, and let's look at the volume of the ventricles when that happens. Oh, we see that the volume increases because the blood is flowing into the ventricles from the atria. So that makes perfect sense. All right, then right at this point in time, right here, we see that the heart starts to contract. And what is the signal for contraction? It is the electrocardiogram, in particular what? The QRS complex. So we see contraction of the ventricles happening right here, and here is the QRS complex. When you look at this, what happens first? Do they happen simultaneously? Here's the QRS complex. Here is contraction of the ventricles as witnessed by an increase in pressure. What happens first? The ECG happens first. This is the signal for contraction, but ECG is not a physical event of contraction. It's the signal for contraction, so the ECG precedes contraction. Right, and so we have now contraction of the ventricles, and as the pressure inside the ventricle exceeds the atria, blood is going to want to flow from a ventricle back into an atrium, but is that allowed in a normal heart? Absolutely not. What prevents that retrograde flow of blood? The valve, the AV valve, right? It's either going to be a tricuspid or bicuspid valve. That slams closed, right? And so now, at this point in time, all valves in the heart are closed. The ventricle still contracts, but if all the valves to that ventricle are closed, can blood enter or leave? If all the doorways are closed, right, then the ventricle can contract, but the shape of the ventricle does not change. And here we see that the shape of the ventricle is not changing, but the pressure is increasing. The shape is not changing because the AV valve is closed and the aortic valve is closed as well. So the pressure shoots way up without any change in the size of the ventricle. So we call this isovolumetric contraction, right? Blood can't go anywhere because all the valves are closed. But as soon as the pressure in the ventricle exceeds the aorta, then what? The aortic valve opens up and blood starts to squirt into the aorta. What happens to the size of the ventricle? Then it starts to decrease once again. Okay, so this just shows us some very important events that are happening inside the heart. Now, this is not the exam figure, but we can use it as an example how to understand the exam figure, which is the one that is in your lab book, right? That is really nice. There are still some errors in that one. There are errors on this particular diagram as well. Like, for instance, if we look at right here, we see that the aortic valve closes. And the AV valve is closed during this period of time. So during this period of time right here, all valves to the heart are closed. So can the size of the ventricle change when all the valves are closed? It can't change. So if we look down on the volume, we see that the size of the ventricle is not changing. So this is what? Also an isovolumetric phase of the heart, because it's not changing shape. But what is happening? It's not contraction. What is happening during this period of time? We see a decrease in pressure. This is relaxation of the heart. So we call this isovolumetric relaxation. This period of time is isovolumetric contraction. But nonetheless, during these isovolumetric periods, all the valves to the heart are closed. What else is interesting on this slide? Oh, so the error on this slide. When would the aortic valve close? The aortic valve should close as soon as the pressure in the aorta is greater than the ventricle, right? Because then blood is going to want to flow from the aorta back into the ventricle. But on this graph, where does that happen? That happens right here. So this blue line actually should be drawn where? All the way over to here and then decrease, right? So there is a little bit of an error on this diagram, and you might find some minor errors in the diagram in the lab manual as well. Just remember that blood will always flow from what? High pressure to low pressure. Okay. So we're looking at the size of a ventricle. Well, I tell you what. The heart has two main phases in order to pump blood. In order to pump blood, it's got to contract. And when it contracts, it's going to pressurize blood and it's going to squirt into the aorta when it's contracting. What's that phase of the heart cycle? Or what's the name of the phase of the heart cycle when the heart is actually contracting? We call that systole right here. So that's an important label. Hopefully that's on the diagram in your lab manual, but I can't quite remember. So systole goes from this line to this line over here. That's when the ventricle is actually contracting. And that's followed by, what's the next phase of the heart cycle? Diastole, and that's when the heart is relaxing. So for years and years and years, clinicians were very, and scientists were very interested in understanding heart function by looking at the systolic events, looking at systole, because that's when the heart is actually pumping blood. Okay, but there is something very important. Before systole can occur, before the heart can pump blood, what has to happen, and it's just as important, and now clinicians are very interested in this part of the heart cycle, and that is diastole, because in order for the heart to pump blood, what has to happen before the heart contracts? It has to relax so that blood can actually fill the heart up. And if the heart can't fill up with blood, even though it contracts, it's not going to be pumping any blood, right? So relaxation physiology or diastole, the physiology of diastole is just as important. Diastolic function of the heart is just as important. So you can't ignore one or the other. Okay? So let's look at these heart sounds. The first heart sound happens when the AV valve closes right here. And when does that happen? When the pressure in the ventricle exceeds pressure in the atria, that closes the AV valves. And the second heart sound happens when, what happens? When the aortic valve closes. And that should happen when the pressure in the aorta is greater than pressure in the ventricle. And that just repeats. There's some minor heart sounds that I'm not so interested that you learn anything about, but you should at least know the first two heart sounds right here. All right, so if you see this diagram, analyze it by looking at the axes that you're trying to understand that graph, either pressure versus time, or volume versus time, or electrical activity as measured on the surface of the heart versus time, or by sound waves, actually, that the heart is producing when it contracts, right? And you should probably know what these things are called, like the phonocardiogram is the heart sound, electrocardiogram is the a trace of the ECG, okay? So those are all good things to know. So hopefully you had a chance to look at this over spring break and ask me some questions. But if you haven't looked at it, my guess is maybe you don't even know enough yet to ask a question, which would be a shame. Because what's next time? Yeah, you've got a test next time, though I do have office hours before the test. So look at this. This is key. Any physiology class you take, you'll have to analyze this particular graph that course that correlates all these different events inside the heart. All right, so we talked about heart sounds already. You can memorize this, but it's probably better for you to have an understanding of why these things close, and that's by looking at pressure differences across the valves. So the first heart sound is closing of the AV valves, right? When the pressure in the ventricles exceeds the atria, then atrioventricular valve is going to close. The second heart sound is closing of the semilunar valves, and that's when the pressure in the arteries are higher than the ventricles, and then the semilunar valves will close. All right, and then don't forget, let me just quiz you really quick. What's that period of time when all of these valves are closed? What is that called? Isovolumetric. So when all the doors to that ventricle are closed, blood can either enter or leave, and so the size of the ventricle can't change. But the pressure can change because the muscle is still contracting in an isometric fashion. Okay. Heart murmurs. These can be produced by a number of flow anomalies inside the heart. I don't have a balloon with me. Anybody have a balloon with you? But you can imagine this. Blow up a balloon. Okay, when we get to lungs, I'll bring a balloon in to model the lungs. But blow up a balloon and occlude the opening to the balloon so that no air can leave, all right? And then make a little hole in the opening, let go a little bit, and so some of the air is going to come out. And as it comes out, what's it going to do? It's going to make a squeaking sound because the little rubbers of the mouth of the balloon are going to vibrate back and forth. It's going to make a squeaking sound. So when you have flow anomalies through different structures, it can vibrate valves or vocal cords even to make a vibration, and that's going to produce a heart murmur. So these are due to abnormal patterns of blood flow in the heart, which then are produced by what? Abnormal structures that are inside the heart. So we want to correlate this abnormal function to some abnormality in the structure of the heart. So heart murmurs can be caused by defective heart valves. And we call these incompetent valves or insufficient valves because they don't close properly or maybe they don't open up all the way. It could be one or the other. Some can be congenital in origin, which means what? You're born with them. They develop during the period of gestation. Other problems can develop over your lifetime, and these are what we call developmental problems. Rheumatic fever is a good example of this. Right? So when somebody has rheumatic fever, they have a streptococcus infection, and your body fights that infection by producing antibodies. Oh, where do you find antibodies? In plasma, right? So there are antigens on this particular streptococcus. It has a particular shape. Your body designs an antibody to attach to that antigen on the streptococcus bacteria, which then causes the demise of that bacterium, right? So you fight that infection. It just so happens that the shape of the antigen on these streptococcus bacteria are similar to antigens that we find on the people's hearts and valves. So not only does a person produce an antibody against the bacteria, they're also producing an autoimmune disease where their antibodies also attack their own heart, right, which is really unfortunate. There are a couple of bacteria, okay, that give us dental caries or cavities, right? So Streptococcus mutans and this lactobacilli right here, it's very possible to produce a vaccine against the dental disease, dental cavities. Unfortunately, the antigens on these bacteria, again, are very similar to antigens that are on a person's heart, so we can give you a vaccination. You'll never have dental disease. You'll never have a cavity. But what else do you have to give up in the process? You have to give up your heart as well, and there just aren't many volunteers for that, and it's never been approved by the FDA, right? So there is cross-reactivity in these antigen-antibody reactions, and you just learned something about that in the previous session. What blood properties do to an antibody-antigen reaction? Is it, I'll give you a hint, is it coagulation or agglutination? Agglutination, so make sure you have those things on the tip of your tongue, okay? Okay, so rheumatic fever is produced by that cross-reaction of a person's own antibodies that will then attack their own heart. Mitral stenosis is talking about the mitral valve. Which one is that? Anybody know what valve that is? Okay, the bicuspid, yes, an AV valve on the left side of the heart. Stenosis means that the valve doesn't open up all the way. It becomes thickened, maybe there's calcium deposits, and that impairs blood flow from the left atrium into the left ventricle. Hopefully you can kind of see that. All right, and since the valve doesn't open up all the way, it makes a funny sound when the ventricle is filling, and you can look at that Wiggers diagram where you would expect to see that abnormal heart sound, okay, by, oh, there's one other thing I wanted to mention. Maybe I'll go back really quick, okay? It would be what when the, during this part of time right here, when the atria are filling up the ventricles through the mitral valve. All right, now what is this point in time right here? We're looking, what are we looking at in this red curve right here? What is it, what are we looking at? We're looking at something versus time, but what? Volume, ventricular volume. All right, so here is one volume, and there's another volume over here, and these are defined on the previous slide, which is what? What is this volume actually called? Okay, what is this volume right here? Is it happening during... Yeah, I tell you what, this volume right here is happening right at the end of diastole, which is this volume right here. It is the end diastolic volume, right? End diastolic volume. And then here is another volume of the ventricle right over here. What is this? This is the end systolic volume. So here you can kind of confirm in your own mind which one is bigger. End systolic or end diastolic? End diastolic volume is bigger than end systolic volume, and sometimes it's important to know how much blood is being pumped by the heart every time it beats. How would you calculate that from this diagram? You would just subtract, right, end systolic volume from end diastolic volume to know the milliliters that the heart pumps out every time it contracts. So what do we call that? That's going to be really important for the next chapter. That's called the stroke volume. That's right. That's how much the heart, how much blood is pumped out of the heart every time it contracts. So you can calculate that from this Wiggers diagram. All right, so I needed to go back and show you that. Accumulation of blood in the left atrium can cause pulmonary hypertension because that prevents the drainage of blood from the lungs. That will back blood up into the lungs, causing pulmonary hypertension. That's just as bad as systemic hypertension that will eventually kill the right side of the heart, and you don't want either side of the heart to die on you, right? How many hearts do you really have? You have one, but how many sides are there? There are two. So basically, you really have two hearts. They're just, what, connected together by the interventricular interatrial septum, right? So I think I drew it on the board. You have the right heart pumping to the pulmonary circulation and the left side of the heart pumping to the systemic circulation. So you really have two hearts, but they're joined together, and functionally, they're connected together as well. It beats as one. Okay, so valves are incompetent when they don't close properly or when they don't open properly either, producing this stenosis right here. So this can be due to damage of a number of different things. Okay, so not only can there be valve disease of the AV valves or the aortic or the semilunar valves, but there can be holes in the septa that separate the chambers of the heart. For instance, you all know in the fetal circulation, there is a normal hole between the right atrium and left atrium so that blood bypasses the lungs during gestation. Because there really is no big reason why a lot of blood should go to the lungs during gestation, because the fetus might be breathing amniotic fluid. That's no big deal. But is there oxygen in the amniotic fluid? No. Right? So that's kind of a futile process. Where does a fetus get oxygen from? The placenta instead of the lungs. So blood will squirt from the right atrium into the left atrium through what do we call a hole in anatomy? Foramen, right? A foramen ovale. So it will move through the foramen ovale from the right atrium into the left, bypassing the lungs. But as soon as you're born, what should happen to that foramen? It should close, and it becomes a fossa, right? So the fossa ovalis is the remnant of that foramen ovale, right? And in some people, it doesn't close, and so it's called a patent foramen ovale, a patent hole in the heart. A patent hole just means that blood can actually flow through it, as opposed to being occluded. And if somebody has a PFO, then that has to be closed surgically, right? And when blood squirts from the right to the left atrium, that makes a squeaking sound, just like air escaping from a balloon, and that's one way to tell that you have a PFO. Some PFOs and some people are undiagnosed for decades, and they eventually go into heart failure later on in life, maybe in their 20s, 30s, even sometimes in their 40s. And then when we try to find out why they're in heart failure, we find that somebody has a PFO even late in life, and then for sure it has to be closed surgically. It used to be open heart surgery, and now it's done endoscopically, very interestingly, right? Just by putting in instruments and catheters from a femoral vein going all the way up to the heart to reach this area right here, which really simplifies the procedure. You're probably not playing baseball the next day, but probably the week after you could, as opposed to if you had a thoracotomy, you'd be in the hospital for weeks, right, with open heart surgery. Okay, and here we see, maybe there could be an interatrial septal defect, but here is what, an interventricular septal defect. And here we see blood squirting from the left ventricle into the right ventricle because there is a septal defect in the interventricular septum, and that will make a large noise as well. And why is blood squirting from the left ventricle into the right ventricle? Why don't you see it from the right into the left? Because the left ventricle produces much higher pressure than the right ventricle, right? And even from anatomy, you realize that the wall thickness of the right ventricle is really thin compared to the left ventricle, which is thick, because the left ventricle has to pump blood through the whole systemic circulation and the right ventricle just through the pulmonary circulation. Oh, there's a nice question right there. Okay, be able to answer that one. Electrical activity of the heart, right? Myocardial cells are short. They're not like skeletal muscle cells. They're also branched, and they're connected with adherens junctions in that intercalated disc. The intercalated disc also has special electrical connections between cells called what? Gap junctions. So this allows for sodium to diffuse from one cell to the next by just a concentration gradient. And when sodium diffuses into a cell, what is that called? That is depolarization, right? And that's an excitatory event. So if there's one cell in the heart where there is high sodium concentration, sodium then will diffuse throughout the whole heart through those gap junctions, causing depolarization or an excitatory event on all these cells, which then leads to contraction. All right, so because the heart is connected by all these gap junctions, we call it a functional syncytium. So all these muscle cells are connected together, even though they're all different cells. Okay, because action potentials originating in any cell are transmitted right through these gap junctions to all the cells in the heart, not just from the base of the heart to the apex, but also from the epicardial surface all the way down to the endocardial surface because, I don't know if I have a picture of a heart cell, I don't, right here, because these cells are what? They're branched. They just don't line up in one layer, but since they're branched, every cell can affect cells above or below them because they are branched. So that branching pattern is very important. Okay, now, however, the atrial and ventricular chambers are separated by non-conductive tissue that we call what, the fibrous myocardium or fibrous skeleton, and connective tissue does not propagate action potential. So the atria are electrically isolated from the ventricles, and we'll see in just a little bit how the atria still can control the action of the ventricles. There's a special region right here, as we see on this slide. All right, so we see some myocardium, right? Here's the epicardium, myocardium made of, what's the myocardium made out of? Contractile cells, these are muscle cells, right? And the endocardium, again, is just very smooth connective tissue. But in yellow, there are some special myocardial cells. These are not nerve cells, but they are specialized not for contraction, and they probably don't contract. But since muscle cells have sodium channels and potassium channels, it can conduct action potentials just like a nerve cell does. So these are specialized muscle cells that we call nodal tissue that are specialized to transmit electrical activity in the heart, right? Which is what? Depolarizations and repolarizations. So you got to know the individual pieces of these nodal tissues. So here is the sinoatrial node in the right atrium. This is the pacemaker of the heart. It spontaneously depolarizes all by itself. It does not need innervation. And this is the pacemaker. It controls contraction of the heart. When it depolarizes, guess what happens to all of the muscle cells of the atria right here? They also depolarize because why? There are gap junctions between all these different cells. Okay? And it is autorhythmic. It will automatically by itself depolarize at a particular rhythm, and this rhythm is very rapid, and so it will control the heartbeat itself, right? So that's why we call it the pacemaker, because it exhibits the fastest rate of depolarization compared to other myocardial cells anywhere else in the atria or the ventricles. Okay, when that wave of depolarization moves through the atria, it moves down to the atrial ventricular node right here. This captures depolarization. And remember, the fibrous skeleton is between the atria and the ventricles. Depolarization can't move from an atrium, say on this the right lateral wall right here, into the ventricles. All right, but nonetheless, the atria do control contraction of the ventricles in the normal heart because here is that special pathway. The nodal tissue of the atrial ventricular valve acts as a delay. It holds on to that depolarization, and after a period of time, it allows that depolarization to move down through the atrial ventricular bundle or bundle of His. And then when it does that, guess what it pierces? Guess what that electrical activity progresses through? The fibrous skeleton of the heart. Right? So now electrical events in the atria can begin to control the electrical events in the ventricles as that depolarization moves through the atrial ventricular bundle. And when it does, this tissue or the bundle branches, the action potential proceeds very rapidly all the way down to what part of the heart is this over here? This is the apex of the heart, and then that electrical activity exits the nodal tissue into the myocardial cells via these Purkinje fibers, and that causes contraction of the apical regions of the ventricles first, and then the depolarization then goes back superiorly up toward the base of the heart, causing successive regions of the heart to contract. All right, so the heart does contract as a unit, but you can see in a very special way. The atria should contract first because what are they doing? They're helping load blood into the ventricles. So they contract first, and then the apical regions of the heart contract next because where are the great arteries located on the ventricles? Are they down here by the apex or up by the base? They're up by the base, right? So heart exits the heart from the basilar regions, not the apical region. So if the basal regions of the ventricles were to contract first before the apex right here, which way would blood have a tendency to be pushed out, be pushed to? down into the apex where it wouldn't have any place to go, right? So the apical regions contract first, forcing blood up into the great arteries of the heart right here. And so these nodal tissues, right, just control contraction of the heart so that both atria contract together and then followed by both contraction of the ventricles together, starting with the apical regions moving back up to the base of the heart. All right, and the AV node acts as a little delay to make sure that the atria contract first. All right, let's look at this plot right here, which is a plot of millivolts versus time. So we're looking at electrical events inside of a cell. So we've got some microelectrodes that we could put inside one cell. And so we see this event right here, where the cell goes from a minus voltage on the inside to positive voltage. What do we call that? That is depolarization. You got points for a quiz on that. I think I gave you points for that. You should tell me when I ask you these questions, all right? And when the voltage inside a side of a cell goes from positive to negative, what do we call that? Repolarization. Yeah, thanks. Okay. So you know the typical scheme for how that happens, right? In a nerve cell, depolarization is due to what? Sodium channels that are opening. Repolarization is due to potassium. It's a little bit different in nodal tissues inside the heart. Plus, we don't see a stable membrane potential. It is always changing, right? We see that the resting membrane potential is really not a resting membrane potential. It is always doing what? It's changing, but what is that change right here? Is it a depolarization or a repolarization? It's a depolarization, which is what kind of event? Excitatory or inhibitory? It's excitatory. So there are special channels in nodal cells that are called HCN channels, which are sodium channels, which are always leaky. They're leaking sodium from the inside, from the outside to the inside of the cell, causing depolarization. And of course, when the cell depolarizes to threshold, what happens? An action potential. All right. But now the heart has different channels right here. There are calcium channels in the cell membrane that open up, and that then allows calcium. Where is calcium normally high? Outside or inside? Outside the cell. That's just a review, right? So now calcium rushes into the cell, and why does that cause depolarization? Because what kind of ion is calcium? It's a cation, right? So when a cation enters the cell, that causes depolarization, which is that causes this limb of the action potential, and then repolarization happens because these potassium channels open up. So this unstable resting membrane potential is what we call a pacemaker potential due to those leaky sodium channels, and that's what causes the SA node to be autorhythmic because it is never really stable. It is always depolarizing or what? Going through an action potential. And depending on the slope of this pacemaker potential, action potentials will come very quickly, one right after the other, but if the slope is very shallow, then there's going to be bigger time between these action potentials, so the heart rate is going to slow down. Okay? It just so happens that in the SA node, the pacemaker potential compared to other nodal tissues in the cell, the slope is relatively steep, and so it captures the whole heartbeat as a result of that. Okay, so be sure you're kind of aware of these different channels in the myocardial cells. All right, so other tissues do have these HCN channels. They can become pacemakers, especially if the regular SA node is damaged or if other parts of the heart are damaged and that pacemaker potential slope increases, they can actually take over the job of controlling heart rate. All right, so, but usually, okay, all the other nodal tissue in the heart has a less of a slope in that pacemaker potential and therefore can't be the pacemaker of the heart. Okay, so if there is another area of the heart that acts as the pacemaker, we call that an ectopic pacemaker. Ectopic means other than a normal site for that pacemaker. Okay, all right, so that's what an action potential looks like for nodal tissue. We should also look at an action potential of a myocardial cell as well. Remember, skeletal muscle can conduct action potentials because they have what? They have voltage-gated channels on them, sodium and potassium channels. So do the rest of the myocardial cells. They have voltage-gated channels in them as well. Myocardial cells really do have a resting membrane potential of about minus 90 millivolts, all right? But when they're depolarized by some kind of stimulatory event to threshold, all right, then they will cause an action potential as well. So here's what an action potential looks like for a contractile cell in the heart. And can you tell that it looks different than nodal tissue? Absolutely. It's a lot longer because it has this plateau phase, right? So it's very, very long. But in every case, this action potential is going to be the same for the myocardial cells and will be the same, right, at one end of the cell compared to the other. It just looks a lot different than an action potential in a nerve cell. So when sodium enters the cell via gap junctions, right, that causes depolarization. When it reaches threshold, then it opens voltage-gated sodium channels for the cell, which causes this rapid depolarization. And repolarization doesn't happen right away because not only are sodium channels open, but there are calcium channels that are opened at the same time. And where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell, so calcium will enter the cell, causing or maintaining depolarization. All right, and what this does for the heart cell is very, very important. Okay, when we look at an action potential, we saw that this region of the action potential produced an absolute refractory period, so that action potentials cannot summate. So this action potential cannot summate either until repolarization takes place. And since we have extended this absolute refractory period, this just means that the heart tissue itself cannot go into tetanus like skeletal muscle can. And that's a particularly good thing because I'm sure we all have been walking down the street and we get a muscle cramp in our leg or arm, and that causes what? Tetanus in a skeletal muscle. Now, what were to happen to you if you're walking down the street and all of a sudden you had a cramp in your heart muscle and it went into tetanus? What would happen to you? In 2 seconds, what would happen? You would lose consciousness. In 2 minutes, what would then happen? Well, your brain would die as a result of that. So these calcium channels in myocardial cells, the contractile cells, prevent tetanus, right, which then prevent your heart from seizing, and that, of course, would be a fatal event. All right, so the plateau phase is due to the calcium channels, and then repolarization is due to the typical kinds of potassium channels that you're aware of that allow potassium to leave. Okay, anybody got a question on that? No? Okay, and I think we've talked about this already. Okay, the Purkinje fibers, the right and left bundle branches, the importance of the AV node is that it has slow conduction properties so that it delays the signal, but in the bundle branches, the conduction speed is maybe 10 times faster. That carries the signal down to the apex very rapidly so that the apex contracts first before the basal regions. Yeah, all the way in the back.
Yeah, I had a lot of problems with this.
This one here?
Yeah, with bundle branch blockage, could that be a precursor to pulmonary hypertension?
A left bundle branch. Well, yeah, because then the left ventricle won't contract with a lot of force. Blood will back up into the atrium, the left atrium right here, which then will impede drainage from the pulmonary circulation, okay, which then is going to produce pulmonary hypertension, which is pretty difficult to diagnose. So it's interesting that you would think of such a thing. It's easy to measure systemic blood pressure. How would you measure systemic blood pressure? By just putting a cup on your arm and measuring the pressure in your brachial artery right here. Okay, which is part of which circulation, pulmonary or systemic? Systemic, so it's easy to get at systemic arteries. But if you're going to measure pressure in the pulmonary circulation, what blood vessels do you need to get your hands on or around? The pulmonary artery, and where is that? Well, that's inside your thoracic cavity. That's really difficult to get at, right? So that's kind of interesting. Maybe you did one thing in lab. Did you measure ECGs in lab yet? I'm sure you did. And you looked at the electrical axis of the heart, and the electrical axis of the heart kind of measures the mass of the left side compared to the right side, as well as the angulation of the heart. Well, when you get into pulmonary hypertension, guess what happens to the right ventricle? It has to get bigger and stronger because it has to develop what? Hypertension, more pressure. So what happens to a muscle when you demand more from it? it gets bigger and stronger, right? So the right ventricle hypertrophies, that shifts the electrical axis to the right. That's an easy way, okay, maybe to get some preliminary understanding if somebody has pulmonary hypertension, if the mean electrical axis of their heart shifts over to the right because of hypertrophy of the right ventricle. I don't know if it's used clinically, but that would be interesting to look at. Does that sort of answer your question? Okay. Okay, excitation-contraction coupling. Depolarization of myocardial cells starts when voltage-gated calcium channels open in the sarcolemma. That's the smooth endoplasmic reticulum inside the cells. There are no ryanodine receptors in myocardial cells, but there are calcium-induced calcium release channels like we have in skeletal muscle. And the troponin, we have the same troponin and tropomyosin system in cardiac muscle that we do in skeletal muscle. But in this particular case, there's not a mechanical coupling between the transverse tubules in myocardial cells like we do in skeletal muscle. It's mostly due to these calcium-induced calcium release channels. Contraction is due to calcium from two places, from the sarcoplasmic reticulum plus the extracellular source of calcium outside the myocardial cells. In skeletal muscle, it's primarily calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum and not the extracellular space. So that's pretty much the only difference. And then relaxation takes place when calcium is pumped out of the cell. Okay, and that stops the cross-bridge cycling between actin and myosin. All right, so here's a diagram that shows a couple events inside the heart. We have a plot of millivolts versus time over here, and that shows the action potential. And you could probably tell me what kind of action potential this is. Is this from nodal tissue, from a neuron, or from contractile tissue inside the heart? Contractile tissue, because now you have this nice plateau phase right here that's due to what kind of membrane protein? Voltage-gated calcium channel, right? A slow voltage-gated calcium channel that remains open, that maintains this depolarization, right, which then maintains this absolute refractory period, so which covers the whole contractile phase of this myocardial cell so that it cannot go into tetanus. That's really what you should see from this slide over here. So there should really be another axis. You have, this kind of looks gray to me, or maybe green. The action potential is gray or green, right? That's millivolts. But this right here, this B curve, is contraction. This is really a physical measurement, so there should be another axis over here measuring maybe length or tension, right? So this is a measurement of length or tension of the myocardium right here. Right, but they're just justified in time so that you can see when they happen. All right, so here is the electrocardiogram. And you probably measured this in lab because there are electrical events that happen in all myocardial cells, and you have millions of myocardial cells. How many myocardial cells do we have? Somebody should Google that. I don't know what the answer is. Probably depends on whether we're Shaquille O'Neal or somebody else, right? But it'd be interesting to know if we have millions or billions, not trillions probably. And if you add up all the electrical events in all those millions or trillions of cells, that's enough to produce electrical changes on the surface of your body. Right? One cell will produce what? An action potential. And if we add millions of these action potentials together on the surface of your body, they look something like this. Right? And this is what we call the electrocardiogram. And that could be spelled with a C or a K, right? The K is a little bit more archaic. It's a little bit more European or German form of the one with a C. But in hospitals, you might find your way to the ECG department, and in one hallway, it's going to be labeled ECG, and another hallway, it's going to be labeled EKG. They're synonymous. They're exactly the same. So we put electrodes on somebody's skin, and we can measure these different waves. And they correspond to, what do these correspond to? Either, about to run out of voice, that would be terrible. Either depolarizations or repolarizations in all those millions of cells. Okay, and it depends on where you put the electrodes to whether they produce a positive deviation or negative deviation. So just for fun, they superimposed what an action potential looks like in a regular contractile cell inside the heart. All right, so the ECG has a number of different waves. Okay, I got to stop for a drink. Unfortunately, I dropped this on the way to class. Does anybody want to open this up? But I did stop and get a napkin right here. Ah, that's not bad. Delay. All right, so maybe I won't talk so loud and I can keep my voice. All right, so the first wave is what? The primavera wave right here. Probably that's how it was named. Okay, I have no idea why it's called the P wave, but that's the first one. This represents depolarization of the atria. Okay, and then just following the depolarization of the atria, that's followed by contraction, right? If you were to look at this slide, depolarization happens before contraction happens because it takes time for excitation-contraction coupling to take place. All right, so why do the atria depolarize first? Tell me something about the structure of the heart. Because that's where the SA node is, right? And that's the pacemaker of the heart. So the atria depolarize first, right? And that depolarization then is delayed by the AV node, and then that's followed by depolarization of the ventricles. So P is depolarization of atria, QRS is depolarization of the ventricles, which then causes contraction of the ventricles, and we can see what that action potential looks like of the myocytes in the ventricles. All right. Also during the QRS, embedded in that signal is a very small signal for atrial repolarization. But it's such a small signal, you can't pick it out. I can't say, well, this R or this S is due to repolarization. It's just that you know that when a tissue depolarizes, what always happens at a later time? Repolarization. So QRS is due to depolarization of the ventricles, which causes contraction of the ventricles, and repolarization of the atria. And then following the QRS, you have repolarization of the ventricles right here, which is the T wave. Okay, and we can measure this on the surface of your body. All right, so here is, what is this question right here? Remember, the ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. What are they? They're a measure of electrical events, right? Either depolarizations or repolarizations. What do we call a machine that acquires and records an ECG? Uh-oh, can I remember? Electrocardiograph is the machine. Electrocardiogram is the piece of paper that you hold in your hand and look at. Okay, so like a telegraph versus a telegram. A telegram is what they give you at the door, right? The telegraph is the machine that used to send that information. I guess there still are such things, maybe. All right, which events occur first in the heart? Mechanical contraction or electrical events? Electrical always happen first, right? And then you have what? Coupling to the mechanical events. So here you see how, and we talked about this already, where the SA node depolarizes, and this is probably really color-coded in a really fancy fashion. You have depolarization in yellow, repolarization in red. So you see depolarization starting at the SA node, spreading over, what, both atria before it enters the ventricles. Why is that? Because the fibrous myocardium prevents it, and the AV node is a delay line, right? It delays the signal from entering the ventricles, right? And then when it's passed, right, then it moves very rapidly down the bundle branches to the apex, all right, and then back up the free walls, spreading depolarization to the myocardium via Purkinje fibers. So the apical regions contract first before the basal regions, and then repolarization happens at a later time. So there's probably even an animation that I have for you in Blackboard for that. This is just what we looked at in the Wiggers diagram already, so you should know what these two heart sounds are due to, right? Are these due to closing of valves or opening of valves? Oh, it says right there. That's not such a good question. Okay, closing of valves. All right, structure of blood vessels. All right, this is just a review for anatomy, but maybe I could ask some of these questions really quickly. Material can enter or leave blood only through a capillary because they're thin, right? What structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? And that's called a precapillary sphincter. And I'm going to you have a picture in your anatomy book, but we have some good pictures in this chapter Name two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. We'll talk about that. Name three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. We'll answer that. Make sure I answer that before you leave. Which layer of a blood vessel forms valves? What layer forms valves in the heart? What are the three layers in the heart? You got epicardium, myocardium, endocardium. Which one of those three makes a valve? The endocardium. Yeah, it's very special because endocardium is smooth and slippery so that it doesn't cause blood clots to form, and valves are right in there with blood, beating blood up all the time when they close, so that has to be smooth, slippery material or endocardium. What's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? I'm going to forget that one, so you're going to have to ask me. All right, so you got three main layers of blood vessels. All right, the externa, the media, and the intima. Some blood vessels have a lot of elastic tissue in them. Those are close to the heart. Again, this is just a review. So we call those conducting arteries. So when the heart contracts and a big bolus of blood is ejected from the ventricle and the aorta accepts that big bolus of blood, the aorta can actually expand. But no problem because it has a lot of elastic tissue. So what happens is the blood flows out of the aorta during diastole. The aorta shrinks back down to its original size, right? So that helps maintain and smooth out blood flow throughout your body. All right, so we got arteries. What's the definition of an artery? Takes blood away from the heart. And it could be oxygenated or relatively deoxygenated, depending on what circulation it's in, right? So you only know an artery by the direction of blood flow. So here is a capillary for exchange because it only has an endothelium. Right? It doesn't have the tunica externa, tunica media. It doesn't have muscles or elastic tissue or connective tissue. You don't have enough blood in your body to go to every capillary bed at one time. So your body has to pick and choose where blood goes. Right? And one of the structures that helps determine that is the precapillary sphincter right here, which is a circular smooth muscle. And that muscle can contract, occluding blood flow, or it can dilate, opening up blood flow to this capillary bed. So a sphincter can either close, right, or allow blood flow through this orifice right here. It can't really prevent retrograde flow like a valve can. So that's the big difference between a sphincter and a valve. Another thing is a valve is passive, but a sphincter is what? Using ATP because it's muscle contraction. So that's a big difference. And when blood is in this area, then there can be exchange between the interstitial spaces and the plasma that's in this blood. So again, things will move by diffusion from high concentration to low through these capillaries right here, precapillary sphincters. Let me just talk a little bit about control. This is going to be important for the next chapter. What controls these precapillary sphincters? Well, you might think that there are nerves that go to them that cause them to contract, but that is not really the case. These precapillary sphincters are controlled by metabolic events in the tissues that are around these capillaries. We call that local control. So for sure on this slide, write down local control, and maybe it's not on the test. Maybe you don't have a question for this one, but in the next chapter that's going to be important. So for instance, let's just say that there's a muscle that this capillary bed is feeding, and that muscle is relaxed. It's not contracting. So is it using up oxygen or not? No, so there should be relatively high oxygen concentration in this area. What about CO2 in this area where there's a muscle at rest? It should be relatively low. What about glucose concentration? Relatively high. What about lactic acid concentration? Should be relatively low, and the pH should be relatively normal, should not be acidic. But now, as soon as that muscle starts to exercise, what happens to those metabolites? What happens to oxygen? Goes down. What happens to CO2? Goes way up. What happens to pH? It goes down. Lactic acid increases. CO2 and lactic acid then cause these muscles here to relax, and when they relax, they dilate, and that allows blood flow to enter this capillary bed, thereby supporting the metabolic events that are happening inside that muscle. But as soon as this muscle stops exercising, CO2 goes down, lactic acid has been washed out, then these capillary sphincters start to contract again, then blood will go to other parts of the body. So we call that local control. The metabolism of this area is controlling blood flow through this capillary bed, not the autonomic nervous system. All right, three types of capillaries I think you're pretty much familiar with already from anatomy. You've got continuous that are joined together by tight junctions. There are some narrow intracellular clefts between the endothelial cells, so some plasma can leak out, but certainly no cells. These are present in most parts of your body, like the muscle, adipose tissue, most places of your body. Fenestrated capillaries have little holes through the cells of the endothelium so that these are leakier. They leak more plasma, right? We find these in kidneys, maybe endocrine glands and intestines. So this enhances exchange if the endothelium has these holes. And discontinuous capillaries are by far the leakiest because these have very large intercellular clefts between the cells. So these are the most leaky, right? But nonetheless, these are all capillaries because they allow for exchange. The most leaky are sinusoids or discontinuous. The least are the continuous type capillaries. You can refer to your anatomy book for that. Veins have very low blood pressure. And what's the definition of a vein again? They return blood back to the heart. Okay. And veins can contract and expand to a large degree, so we say they are very compliant. They can change their diameter with relatively little change in pressure inside the vessel. All right? And as a matter of fact, pressure inside of a vein is very low, about 2 millimeters of mercury. That's very, very low. Which means then, in order to get blood back to the heart, that's not very much pressure that's going to force blood from a vein back to the heart. But is it important to get blood back to your heart? Yeah. Absolutely. So when it contracts, that it has something to pump. Well, there are two pumps that help venous blood return back to the heart. Okay, and as a matter of fact, let me see. Oh, that's the last slide. That's nice. Okay. So what is going to make blood move from one place to another? Okay, it's going to be a pressure gradient, right? Blood is going to flow from where? High pressure to low pressure. So if you have blood in a vein and you want to get it back to the heart, you either have to decrease the pressure inside the heart or increase the pressure inside of a vein. And how can that be done? Can be done by increasing the pressure in veins. All right, so think of a balloon that we've blown up and we've tied the mouth of the balloon off so that air can't escape. We grab that balloon and we squeeze the balloon down like that. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Just an intuitive sense. We're not going to talk about the physics. Is it going to change? Do you think it's going to change or not change when you squeeze down? It's going to change. Is it going to go up or down? The pressure is going to go up, right? So as you decrease the volume, the pressure is going to go up. We call that an inverse relationship. We're going to talk about that some more next week, right? When something changes in an opposite direction. That's an inverse relationship. So when you squeeze down on the balloon, the pressure goes up. Same thing with a vein. Here we have a vein, and up over here is the heart, down over here is the extremity. So here are your fingertips, over here is your heart on top of it. We want blood to flow in which direction? To the heart. We don't want it to flow back down to your extremities, right? That's going to cause problems, which we can talk about. Well, this vein is going to go between a couple muscles. When these muscles contract, what do? They bulge, right? They bulge way up like that. They compress this vein, and so there's going to be a high pressure in this segment of the vein, and blood is going to want to squirt up to the heart or squirt back down to an extremity, but it can't go back down to an extremity because why? Because there are valves and veins. Arteries do not have valves because they don't have problems with that pressure gradient. And probably you've seen these valves before. Maybe you've been working out sometime in your life or seen somebody lift weights and their veins pop out, and every once in a while you see like a little special bulge in an area of a vein, and that's just a valve that is trapping blood from being squirted back down to an extremity, right? It's going to force blood back up to the heart, right? So we call this the skeletal muscle pump. When you contract skeletal muscle, it pressurizes blood in these veins, and it squirts back to the heart because why? Veins have valves in them. And these valves are made out of which layer of the blood vessel? The endothelium, just like the endocardium makes valves inside the heart. So these are smooth, slippery structures. And of course, you can see that these leaflets of these valves, if the diameter of the vein extends because of pathology in the valve to where the flaps can't touch each other or approximate each other, then what happens to the function of that valve? It can't function, and then you have, right, varicose veins, and you have trouble with venous return back to the heart. And whenever blood stops flowing, guess what blood has a tendency to do? It has a tendency to agglutinate or to clot. And so that's going to form clots in people's extremities. And of course, that's very dangerous because then that can cause pulmonary embolisms or strokes or heart attacks when that happens. All right, so that's one pump. There's another pump that helps. And let's think of respiration. So air moves from one place to another just like fluid, like blood will flow from where to where? Blood flows from high to low. Air is going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. The same physics is involved. So when you have air entering your lungs, what can you tell me about the pressure inside your chest? Is it higher than atmosphere or lower? It's got to be actually lower, right? Because air is going to flow from high to low. And for air to enter your lungs have to be low pressure compared to the air. And you make the pressure in your lungs lower by, and it's that inverse relationship, by making your thoracic cage bigger. When you make the thoracic cage bigger, the pressure decreases, right? Just like when you squeeze on a balloon, it makes the pressure higher. Okay. So when you expand your rib cage, air flows into your lungs because there's low pressure inside your thorax. But if there's low pressure inside your thorax, not only is air entering your thorax, what else is entering? Blood is also entering because now your thorax is at a lower pressure. So we call that the respiratory pump. So there are two important pumps for helping venous return. One is the respiratory pump when you expand your rib cage, causing a decrease in pressure, or when you contract skeletal muscles. All right, so who's going to go to Denpasar over summer break? Anybody? Going to hop on an airplane, take a 16-hour airplane ride someplace? Where's Denpasar? Like Bali, you know, someplace way down over there. Should you sit in that airplane for 16 hours and not move? Yeah, maybe if you take a prescription medication, you could do that. But it's probably best to get up and do what? Exercise a little bit. And what's the purpose for that exercise? It increases venous return, it prevents stasis, venous stasis right here, which can prevent blood clots. And people do, every once in a while, do get pulmonary embolisms on these really long flights or if they're immobilized for whatever reason. All right, so it's not a bad idea to exercise. All right, now what was the question that I asked you to remind me? The difference, we talked about the difference between a sphincter and a valve, but there was something that had three in it. Name three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. And it's probably in this chapter, but we didn't cover it in here. We covered two. What are some structures, cardiovascular structures that have valves? What's the purpose of a valve? It prevents retrograde flow. It keeps blood flowing in the one proper direction. So what cardiovascular structures have valves? Heart. How many does it have? Yeah, it's got four. Okay, what else? Veins. And then one we haven't talked about yet. There's another type of cardiovascular system that's called the lymphatic system. And lymphatic vessels are like veins. So you can imagine, just like veins, lymphatic vessels have valves as well. And lymph is returned back to the heart basically through the same two mechanisms that venous blood is returned to the heart. And so how is lymphatic fluid returned to the heart? What kind of pumps are used by your lymphatic system to return it to the heart from your extremities? When muscles bulge, we call that what? The skeletal muscle pump, and the respiratory pump helps return lymph back to the heart as well. All right, so those are the three structures. Veins, lymphatic vessels, and heart have valves to prevent retrograde flow. Okay, so that's it for this chapter. So a week from today, probably you should go ahead and read the next chapter, which is cardiac output, blood flow. Then we're going to be using all of these concepts to get through that chapter. But next time, you have a test. Okay, and does anybody have a question what's on the test for next time? Maybe you should tell me. 12 and 13. Okay, we're all on the same page.